Chapter 18. My Lord Remilius, I have seen Jesus, and bring his reply to you so that you can give it to the governor, Pilate. My news is not good, and I fear greatly for Jesus, for his life and the lives of all who follow him. Not only have I carried out your commands, but also I have done them in the manner in which you instructed. I believe you would have been pleased. Neat, little, sharp as a glass shard, Charlie Gauntlet read on, experiencing a slight shudder, which he put down to the coldness of the monastic cell. In reality, he knew it was about sharing, on the brink of staking claim in some extraordinary plot, far outside the biblical framework with which he was familiar. When I arrived in Bethany, I sought out the house where Jesus is lodging. His needs are being cared for by two sisters, Martha and Mary, who quarrel endlessly. Martha is tall and thin, with huge energy and a wart on her chin. She complains that Mary lets her do all the cooking and work in the kitchen. Mary is small and stout, smiles constantly, and lets Martha's complaints slide off her like water from a fish. When I got to the house, I was told that Jesus was out teaching, leading the people in prayer and healing, in an open place a little beyond the town. When I said I carried a special message for the master, the serving woman, who was called Susanna, asked me to come in, and gave me some cold meat, bread, and a cup of wine, for I was tired and hungry after the journey. Susanna talked most freely of Jesus and his followers, and I, remembering how you had counseled me, gave nothing away, but rather encouraged her to speak. I fear that when the others are here in the house, which is large, she gets little opportunity to talk. She makes up for it now. She says that Jesus is usually out and about from early in the morning until late in the afternoon, and I can see why, for the town appears to be bursting with people who have followed him here. The streets are crowded, there is no place at the one inn, and people are making money from letting out their rooms to travellers. They do a brisk trade. I saw many in the streets who were obviously sick, crippled, or maimed, brought here especially to see Jesus. Blind people are led about by friends or relatives, and a great sense of happiness is among the crowds. They're excited, and at the same time respectful. Susanna told me several stories of how Jesus has healed the sick. She has seen it with her own eyes. And I believe her, for she's an ordinary woman who has not the wit to invent some of the stories. She has watched the lame throw away their crutches and walk again, watched Jesus make the blind see, restore hearing to the deaf, and in one case she's heard a dumb man speak again. As I say, I believe her because I've seen wonders myself, but also there seem to be many others whom he has not healed. She gives details, which she could only know if she was present. For instance, he said to one, "Take up your bed and walk." This man had not walked for several years, yet he did so when Jesus commanded it. Then a man whose sight was returned to him said he could see men like trees walking. Just outside the house were 30 or 40 people waiting. Some were blind, and 4 or 5 were too sick to stand, so their beds were litters on the ground close to the door. I should report to you that these same people who were outside when I arrived were still there when I left. So if Jesus is the Messiah, the Christ, God come down to make himself known to us, then he does not heal all people. Some are left by the wayside of life, not healed, not brought out of sin and into life eternal. It would seem that the just and the unjust are treated in an indiscriminate fashion, the reason for which is known only to God. Can one believe this? Charlie wanted to write in the margin. In a universe that produces so many interlocking wonders, can we believe in a God who visits random good and evil on his creations? Can we believe in a God at all? A picture of magnified snowflakes came into his head. Then the horror of his mother dying of cancer, diagnosed 1 September and killing within 3 months. The long hours of agony, the mind fuddled with drugs. Again in his head he saw film footage of bodies, the Western Front during World War I. Then the Kosovan and Bosnian refugees from the end of the last century. And a voice whispered in his ear, "Free will, that's the reason. God gave man free will, and it is man's inhumanity to his own that brings the hell." Charlie knew this was some university argument from his past, And he went back, uneasy, to reading Naomi's narrative, which continued dramatically. Romilius, the other thing you should know is that Jesus continues to upset many people. In particular, he is making enemies among other teachers of our faith, arguing with the priests and holy men, belittling them. He has especially angered the Pharisees, who put a reliance in the holy law of our people and preach the strict way of life and obedience, almost to the exclusion of everything else. Also, he has many enemies in their rival party, the Sadducees. Wise and learned men from both factions have tried to trick him with ingenious questions, for these men are experts in argument when it comes to the holy book, in particular the law. Yet Jesus has been able to beat their contentiousness. Strangely, the Pharisees and the Sadducees are normally at each other's throat in argument, but they seem to be united in their attacks upon Jesus. I know this is all true about the enemies, because you may remember the odious Thomas, who was steward to Caiaphas the high priest, and became one of my clients. Well, that Thomas told me Caiaphas was forever trying to find ways to entrap Jesus, for he, with the other priests and members of the Sanhedrin, believed that Jesus was guilty of blasphemy, and also questioned further teachings, causing many arguments and fighting among those at the heart of our religion. So you must tell Pilate that these men are really dangerous and not to be trusted. They will stop at nothing to have Jesus arrested and punished. Susanna was telling me more of Jesus' teaching when he returned with three of his closest followers, Simon, Barnabas, and a man I'd not seen before called Judas, who comes from a southern village, Kerioth. This last is very pleasant, laughing and joking all the time. Even Jesus laughed heartily at his jokes. Then Jesus was called away to talk with Martha, who had also arrived back, in some turmoil, with her sister. The thing I notice most is the happiness. Everyone near the master has a smile, and there is laughter everywhere, real laughter from the belly. Nobody looks gloomy, sad, or serious, except when they talk of Jesus' future. Later, Judas began to ask me about the Roman garrison, plying me with questions about the way order is kept in Jerusalem, the names of the officers, and the disposition of the nightly watch. At first I did not know how he expected me to be familiar with these matters, but soon it became clear that he knew who I was, how I earned my living, and that my money comes usually from officers of the Roman garrison. Then he began to stand a little too close to me, making remarks that could only have one interpretation, and I became greatly embarrassed by him. He is not the first follower of Jesus who has displayed a little lust, and I don't suppose he will be the last. My kind always sets them off, and I wish I could find some other life. It is humiliating how often they treat me with contempt when others are near, yet when they are alone with me, things change. In this case, it is a pity, because Judas seems a nice and good man. In the end, I had to ask Simon if I could speak alone with the master. This was arranged, and I was taken to him, so that eventually I gave him your message, as though it came directly from Pontius Pilate. At first I thought he was angry with me, but then he smiled and placed a hand on my shoulder. "Naomi," he said quietly, "Naomi, I have to do my father's work. You know this. You have heard my teaching. It is necessary for me to go to Jerusalem at this time. Please understand this. I must go so that the ancient prophecies can be fulfilled. All this is necessary. At Passover, there must be a sacrifice." I said that everyone was afraid for him. He said he understood, and repeated that it was his obligation. "If you believe in me, there is no need to fear for me. I have told you already that to believe in me and follow my way will never be easy. I shall always be with you, though not as you see me now, and I shall give you strength to experience all the bad things that will happen to you, because you believe in me. Believing in me and following the path that I signpost for you will be the most difficult part of your life." Then something strange happened. He asked me if I knew of any large room in which he and his closest disciples could hold the Passover meal, which of course also requires some preparation. Without thinking, I said they could use the upstairs room in my house. So he asked how he could get in touch with me. By this time I was embarrassed again. I am overflowing with sin, and this is a holy man. To be in his presence is difficult for me, I stand next to him and feel like a diseased woman nudging close to a healthy person.